So I'm really excited to answer these questions today. I actually want to preview a little bit what we're going to cover. We had questions about what to assign a virtual assistant, how to even know what to assign first in a studio, how to balance social media time, promoting your social media in business versus time you spend personally, and what's the balance to strike there. Someone asked about how Nate communicates his long-term plan to his families to support retention. I think that's going to be a fantastic answer. A really good question about how to balance home life versus work life when you're a business owner. How do you make time for family and personal things? And I think not only do I feel passionate about a response there and maybe have some things to contribute, we might even have folks in the audience or the live audience here contributing in that way. So that's just a little bit of a taste of what we're going to start with today. I actually want to start with that social media question. I'm going to just read it out loud here. I try to limit my time on social media and my personal life. Can I still market my studio successfully online without a presence on Facebook or Instagram? Or do you have any creative solutions for using social media without getting sucked into a scrolling black hole? So Nate, do you want to start with that one, or do you want me to start with that one?
No, you tee it up there, Daniel. I'm curious your thought on that. I know you know how I roll with social, so I've got some shares too.
Okay. So what's interesting is that the day that we are recording this live podcast is actually the day we released episode 113 with Lauren Kelly. And actually, she and I talked for a long, long time about how to grow your social media and even what that means. But I will just say personally that I am not a heavy social media user. I tend to flock more towards YouTube because I like watching and learning. And I think YouTube is a good platform for learning, but it's not really a social media platform. I have a personal Instagram. I've got a personal Facebook. I will sometimes go a week without checking either. However, at the same time, when I had a studio, I was a heavier social media user. I still divided my time between when I use social media for personal use and when I use it for business use. And essentially, I curated my social media so I got the experience I wanted. And in some cases, I had two separate logins, two separate accounts for those things, for personal and for business. So I kept them separated and curated my feeds so that they were minimally distracting. That's one tip. So, you know, potentially separate logins, being very careful about what you follow. If you're not a heavy social media user and you're begrudgingly using it, it is worth it to use social media for business use. Another thing I would say is that it was a small aspect of how I marketed then. It's a bigger aspect of how I market now. I have outsourced a lot of stuff that we do on business social media to an assistant. So I'm on social media even less. It's really only when I need to personally interact. So a lot of times when I comment on, you know, someone comments and I comment back, or I'm going out and looking at what's going on in, you know, various social media channels in our industry, it is actually me commenting. I set aside times to actually do that. It's planned into my week. So it is a situation where it's almost like it doesn't get away from me because I plan things in advance and I'm on a timetable. And for me to just sit there and kind of go into a social media wormhole for 2 hours, because I have a plan in advance, it kind of defends against that. Although I will say sometimes I do. I had a dorky little bit of time between when I finished lunch and when we started this live podcast. And I got on Twitter and was just looking at various accounts from people in our industry, made a comment to Eric Branner over at Fonz.com, you know, just different things. And, you know, we're not all immune, but I think my social media use is very curtailed just because of the discipline I put around it. The other part of the question, and I'm going to kick it over to you, Nate. Can I still market my studio successfully online without a presence on Facebook or Instagram? I would say you could. But it's a little bit like, I don't know why in 2024 someone would want to do that. The only way I would say that, you know, you don't have to do that is if you're already getting the number of leads that you want. But so if you're full, you're already getting a ton of leads from other things that you're doing, then sure, don't have social media accounts. But at the very least, setting up a social media account and regularly posting pictures, performances, you know, fun glimpses into the studio, stuff like that, and then just growing a following can be so helpful. Even if the following is only 500, there's so many things that you can do if you put in that minimum effort. And I talk about that in my Facebook guide. You can go to growyourmusicstudio.com/FB guide. And I talk about a little bit in a free training we do, growyourmusicstudio.com/free training, just one word. And I talk about how to use social media in such a way that it promotes growth, it promotes social proof, it contributes to people who are in your studio currently valuing you more. All of that I cover in those two resources. They're both free. So I don't really think social media is an option at this point. I really think everyone should have it. If not, someone else who is taking it seriously, perhaps even someone who doesn't like social media just as much as you don't like it, but realizes what a powerful tool it is. They're building a social following. They're building a local presence with social media. They're eventually going to beat you. And I just... it's fundamentally a competitive game. And if you're not participating, you're getting behind. So those are my thoughts. Nate?
Daniel, I think I'm going to work backwards and take the last thought you had. It's a little bit like not having a sign at this point. Like, you don't put a shingle out in front of your studio. Like, Brooklyn Music Factory just opened up a new space. Daniel and I were hanging out at it all weekend, this past weekend. And one of the most valuable pieces of the space and what we're literally paying for is a street level commercial presence with signage. Like, to the point where we had too many signs. Like, our architect came and visited the other day. I didn't tell you this, Daniel, but he was like, Nate, can you take a couple of the decals down off the window? Because it's a little extreme right now, and you kind of look like a deli on the corner, the ones with, you know, like, where they've just put pictures of food everywhere. I was like, okay, I dig it. So I totally am with you, Daniel. And I think the second piece that you sort of threw in there that's so important is that it just 100% does not need to be you. I literally, one of my best friends, he and his wife run this amazing Pilates studio, like, 8 blocks from me here, and they've been in business 27 years, and their social media has always just basically sucked, right? They've never really done it. But now their daughter is like 24 or 5, and they just hired her to manage the Instagram, right? Just because, like, they know, as Daniel put it, that it's not really an option. It's not optional anymore. And so does it have to be like a perfect social media presence? It totally does not. I don't think I agree with Daniel. It's not optional anymore. You need to have some presence. At BMF, we only have the IG. We don't really, I mean, we may post on Facebook, but we don't manage it at all. We only really manage Instagram, and we only comment there. And there's only a few other things that I want to say on this, because a lot of it, I think everybody already sort of intuits. The first is, you really have to, as a sound business owner, doesn't matter if you're a single teacher studio, doesn't matter if you're a multi-teacher school like BMF, but you, one of the habits that you're going to develop, speaking to Daniel, your comment about how you compartmentalize time, like, Daniel is a hella better at this than me, way better at this in terms of, like, being really specific and organized in his task management and his time management. I mean, I think, Daniel, maybe you're not doing it currently, but you certainly were for a long time tracking every week, you know, what you spent. Are you still doing that right now?
Still am, yeah.
Still am. Okay, so dig it. There you go. I'm not like that. However, I have developed the habits of knowing what hat I'm wearing and when. Just being like I woke up this morning, I came in to let in the HVAC people that have to fix something so that we can do something for our space, and I'm wearing a very different hat than I am right now. That was literally just facility manager because I had to play that role from 9 a.m. to 9 to 10 a.m. And then after that, I was CEO and CFO. So I update my dashboard and that takes me about 20 minutes. And then I contemplate cash and things like that and all the marketing metrics for about 10 minutes. And I'm like, anything I need to do there? Nope, everything looks fine, right? But I'm just taking one hat off, putting on another. Then I gave then someone came to visit, a prospective teacher, and I gave him a tour of the space. That's a totally different hat, right? So one hat that I loathe wearing is social media. I don't use it personally, you know? Like, yeah. I would like to be into it. Why would I like to be into it? Because both my 20-something-year-old daughters are into it. So it's a great way to actually keep track of your kids is to just follow them on Instagram, you know? But the reality is I don't even really want to open it up for that. So the hat that revolves around what I consider mostly to be Daniel's points on brand awareness, and then Daniel, you made the really good point that it's really good for retention because most of what we're posting is all about our purpose and values. Right. And our methodology. So you should absolutely follow Brooklyn Music Factory on Instagram and just be like, why are they posting that? And you're going to see it. It's mostly like big music games, songwriting, and community. And once in a while, it's promoting our camps. And those are very purposeful marketing posts. Right. Mm. But basically, it's the same like trilogy over and over and over and over and over. Right. And so we're highlighting our families here. The students, the original songs they're writing, et cetera. Why? Because it just reinforces our purpose and our methods. So families that run across that are like, oh, that's why I'm a member of this community. Mm. And that's radically different, you guys, than that's why I take a piano lesson. That's not what we're doing here. And if you guys are fans of the podcast, which I'm sure you are because you wouldn't be here otherwise, like Daniel and I talk about this constantly. Like you got to know your purpose and you got to message it over and over. Last thing I'll say is, you know, just a basic tactic. Like Daniel, you put it really well. You get on there for a very specific purpose and that's to comment. You're getting on there to interact. You're probably doing some analysis to try to see what's working and what's not from other companies and what they're posting. My guess is you're looking there some, you know, but mostly you're very clear on your why before you even turn the sucker on. You're like, I'm going on there and I'm going on there to comment. And actually you and I were just talking about this weekend around school and just managing some of our communities. And like, it's really important that I jump on to some of these different communities I'm a member of just to say hello and to comment and to communicate, right? That's the social element of it. But know the why and then set a timer and honor it. Just 10 minutes. When the timer goes off, just be like, well, I did the best I could. We're done for Wednesday. Put the thing down and then just put on a different hat. Right? Yeah. That's the way I approach it. So,
yeah. I'll even jump in with one more thing. Back in the day, I used to, you know, have performances I'd upload to my social channels. I would have pictures I'd upload. I'd write the captions, that sort of thing. And I would save them until Sunday. And when I was watching football on Sunday afternoon, during the mini commercial breaks, I would kind of batch my scheduling. And I'd do it right from my phone in commercial breaks. So it was kind of, you know, not wasting my time. And I'd schedule out the post for the coming week. Just a fun little hack. This actually is a good segue to a question that Josh asked. I think he's here still. What are the first few tasks that you guys outsourced in your own studios? Did you hire a part-time assistant or virtual assistant or a current staff member? We're going to answer this one. Then I'm going to go to the question that Amy asked about retention, the 10-year plan, how you communicate that, Nate. But we're going to get this one first. What's interesting about that assistant question was one of the first things I handed off to my assistant was the batch scheduling of all of those social media tasks so that I could enjoy the commercials in peace for the football games. I also handed off invoicing and keeping track of payments to a virtual assistant. I handed off onboarding and offboarding of students in the studio. So it got done much more robustly. When I was doing it, it was perfunctory. Oh, you know, get them into this list, get them into the CRM. It was done begrudgingly. I was doing it like at 9:30 at night after my workday was over. I handed that off to Alicia. And then she had suggestions. And so we ended up having a 9-step onboarding process that included things that were much more warm and friendly. She designed some emails that got sent to people and reminders, and she was communicating with them. It was awesome. Then we had basically the mirror image of that in offboarding. If someone was leaving the studio, she had this offboarding process where she systematically took them out of all the different places. She took them off the schedule. She took them out of our CRM or moved them in the CRM to ex students. She gently reminded people to fill out the exit survey, and she would hound them about that again, politely. Whereas if it were me, it was just another thing that was a task at the end of my week. And a lot of times I'd skip it so I wouldn't get exit interview data from people. Just a lot of things that she did. And I think the underlying principle of all this is that she did things that I didn't need to be doing. And then because I hired someone really good, she actually expanded on what I was doing and made all the things that I handed off to her better. She made them better. She had suggestions. We were having weekly meetings that first 6 months that she was working for me, where as she got more familiar with the ethos of my studio, as she got more familiar with my working and communication style, as she got more familiar with what my values were, she started making creative suggestions where it was a blend of her operational talent and skill and what she was learning about how I wanted the business to run. And so she came up with things that were specific to my studio. If she'd been working with someone else, she may not have been making those suggestions. And that's just the mark of a good VA or a good executive assistant. They begin to learn you. They begin to learn how you think. And she asked great questions in meetings. She was part-time and she was virtual. She lived... I never met her in person, actually. Now, there's people I've hired since that time that I have met in person or worked with in person. Kind of my right hand right now is a young gal named Bethany. She'll end up doing a lot of work to get this podcast out. She and I work in person 3 to 5 times a month. She actually came to New York to work with Nate, Alyssa, and myself over this past weekend. Over the past year, she's become invaluable in that. Is part of the fact that she's just a really quality person. The other part of that is that I have put an increasingly larger amount of time into actually taking time to meet with her, answer questions, help to cast the vision of what it is that we're doing around here so that she just does things now and she kind of understands why we're doing what we're doing and can make higher level decisions. So that's kind of my answer to that. I think if a studio has mastered their marketing, they're at capacity or near capacity, I think every studio should have a part-time VA to take care of those 5 hours of admin tasks that you inevitably have to do each week. By the time Alicia stopped working for me, she was actually planning my recitals. She was doing a lot of work. She was communicating with parents, sending them reminders. We had systems for all this. Every time we did a recital, she had this checklist of things that she had to do. So it's like 26 weeks before recital, do this. 20 weeks before recital, do this. 18 weeks before recital, do this. 14 weeks. And she would go in and build this project based on the recital date and put the due dates in for herself and for me. And our recitals ran so smoothly. A lot of times I'd just show up on the day and everything was done. It was just awesome. That happened after she'd been with me for a while and we'd really established a lot of baseline systems. But I would just say that if your studio's at this place where you're at capacity or near it, you've kind of mastered your lead flow, then take a couple $100 a month or even more and dedicate it towards getting all this stuff off your plate. And then if you so choose, take maybe a couple hours of the time that you save. So maybe this person saves you 10 to 20 hours a month. Maybe take 4 hours a month and put it into more teaching to kind of for an equilibrium, if you want an equilibrium in income. Yeah, it's basically trading time. Because especially if you're teaching group lessons, you can certainly afford to teach a group lesson for, you know, add one group per month. So that's 4 hours of additional teaching time per month, but then hand off 20 hours of admin tasks that you would have otherwise had to do, including social media, including onboarding, offboarding, admin tasks, ordering books for you, ordering materials and supplies, communicating with parents with low-level communication, this all this stuff that just nags at you. Do that. It was great. By the time I finished teaching, I basically was only teaching because Alicia was handling everything else. And she built basically a systems manual for my studio so that when she left, I actually had another gal come in named Kirsten, and she picked up right where Alicia left off. And there was even a little bit of overlap time between them so that Alicia actually, even though there was a systems manual, Alicia was available for Kirsten to ask questions so that when Alicia left, it was a perfectly smooth transition. Everybody should be doing this. Yeah.
I'm gonna pick up where you left off with that when you said, and all that stuff, Daniel, all that stuff, probably a lot of our listeners are like, man, I have a list that's not even complete of all that stuff. So let me give you a tip on how to even get started. Number one, make your not to-do list. Josh and I talked through this before. Just make what is the stuff that, as Daniel put it, you resent?
Yeah.
Right? And it's sort of like your journal. Like, nobody's reading it. Don't worry about it. You can be as candid as you need to be with yourself. Like, I'm not showing anyone else my not-to-do list unless it's like a, you know, coaching client or somewhere where I'm like, take a look at my Evernote. Right? But I'm not really showing anyone this. And then from your not-to-do list, I sort of think about it this way. I frame it like this, Daniel. I go, first of all, I do cash. The question was, what was the first thing you outsourced? The first thing I outsourced was billing. Why? Because cash is the fuel of your business, period. Like, if you run out of cash, you're screwed. There's a reason why cash is king, is what they say. You need fuel, right? And fuel is cash and time and creativity. Those are your three fuels. So you need to make sure you have all three of them. When Daniel says by the time he got done teaching, he like all he did was teach, that's because he was conserving fuel. It's creative energy. It's the ability to show up to his students, right? If you are doing everything, you're running out of that fuel, basically. If you're teaching a five-day week, by Wednesday afternoon, you're already low to empty. Thursday, Friday gets budget. Your Friday students, you should move to somebody else because they can already tell you you're probably not delivering on promise. You know? So, okay, so the first thing I do is I assess cash. Is there anything I can outsource that ensures that cash is moving efficiently? So processing billing was one of the very first things we outsourced. Why? Because I'm not detail-oriented. That's not very good for me. It's not like a superpower for Nate to go in and check boxes and make sure that every last invoice is processed and that we've collected on all failed credit cards. Like, don't hire me to do that at your school because I'm not going to help you very much. Okay, so that was one of the very first things. The second thing we outsourced, bookkeeping. Why? Because if you don't have clean books, you can't be strategic about growth. I'm going to repeat that. If you do not have clean books and you can't see where you are today, see where you were this time last year, and see where you want to go this time next year, it's very difficult to make wise growth choices. Everybody probably knows this already, because you probably do it in your personal life, where you sort of intuit a few things around your personal finances, and then you wake up a year later and you're like, that credit card debt appears to show me that maybe it wasn't such a great choice to buy that boat. No, I've never bought a boat, but you know what I mean. Anyways, so that's the second thing I outsourced. The very first way I outsourced it, by the way, was I just went to a BMF mom who was a bookkeeper at another school, and I just started bartering lessons with her child, and she started managing the books. So anyways, there's ways around your cash flow if you need to outsource through bartering with parents. The third thing we outsourced, I put in the retention category. So the retention category, of course, is all about delivering on promise and messaging. We're going to talk about that in another question. But it's all about messaging what your purpose, methods, and the why behind it, and how each family is succeeding or child is succeeding on their journey, right? And so you're going to get a ton of questions from parents. Every single week, you get a parent asking a question. That was really difficult for me to keep up with. Not very good at that. Same reason why I'm not opening social, right? Is I'm not opening my email. Not very good at that. I'm really good live, but not good digitally answering the thing. So we hired we brought someone on, a teacher, as an admin support, and they were called the Family Experience Facilitator. It's kind of a thief. That's what we called them. Anyways, he literally, all he did was manage all the frequently asked questions, and he had email templates for everything. So anything from how do I access this thing to how do I order a book to what keyboard would you recommend? He just answered all those. And so that was an interesting, I put that in the retention bucket. It was worth investing in that and delegating that to somebody else with admin support because it would increase our retention. The final thing that we did was I put in sales. So sales generally is the thing that people want to let go last. And I think with good reason, because who else is going to be as good or as passionate about what you do than you, right? I've learned a lot, and I've watched Daniel do sales in all kinds of environments, you know, and he's really, really good at it, really good at it. And I used to do sales at BMF. I don't anymore, though I do it in the context of open houses or public events. So book Nate for this kind of thing. But don't put Nate on the phone like 9 times a week with new inquiries. Again, same reason I wouldn't be very good at it. But I did it to get BMF started, right? Because same reason you guys are probably doing it. But the first sales that I outsourced was to the product that had gained traction and that didn't need me on the phone with.
Such and a good advice. Camp.
Yeah, that was Camp. For us, Camp found its footing in around 2015-ish. So 5 years into our business, into the company. And then we brought on someone to handle Camp sales. And we never looked back. I've never, ever sold a Camp spot since. Mm. You know, and so that's the last thing I'd say. If you've got a product in your suite that converts highly and you're confident with it, then that would be a great place to, like Daniel was saying, bring on someone who's already maybe doing one or two other things that could handle that sales funnel for you.
Yeah. Two thoughts. Yeah, two thoughts before we transition. One, there was a comment made in the chat, and I just want to address it. Mm. And that is, I think one of the reasons why I waited so long to hire just a very, very part-time person was I didn't believe, and this is crazy, I didn't believe that someone would only want to work 5 hours a week. Yeah, I thought, I don't have a full-time job here for someone, so of course no one would want that. I don't know where I acquired that belief. I don't know why I thought that. In my mind, there was just no category for that. Now, maybe anyone listening, maybe you don't have that. Maybe you're like, oh, of course someone would work part-time or micro-time. Great. You might have another limiting belief. That just was mine. So if you can identify the belief you have that seems to be the biggest sticking point, at least you have something you can work on now. It would be worthwhile to work through why you think you can't do it. Oh, I can't trust this person. Someone wouldn't want to work this little. Why would someone want to work for me? Just who knows? The other thing that I also saw in the comments, start people with just a couple small defined tasks that are very process-based, like the billing, like scheduling the social media posts. Let the person know that they're going to be working micro time, but that you're going to be meeting with them every week. And here's what ended up happening with Alicia. The first month that she worked for me, I think she worked somewhere between 8 to 10 hours for the entire month. 5 months later, she was working 100 hours a month for me. And it just grew because I learned who she was and I learned what she was capable of. And this thought that I've noticed a lot of student owners have, which is, well, what would they do for me? I actually co-created that with her. And I ended up putting her on other projects that, yes, admittedly, they were outside the scope of my studio because I had this business as well. But even within the studio, I expanded what she was able to do. Like, I could have never imagined her doing my recitals for me. I could never have imagined that. So again, it's one of the classic case of just start small and then build from there. But the problem that most people, the problem that I observe with a lot of just people in general is that they wait years and they're thinking about it. They're trying to overcome a problem that they're only working out in their head. This is me. This was the problem that I had, was that I just waited for years to actually pull the trigger on this. And then when I finally did, just things exploded for me. And I it was one of those things where I wish I'd done it earlier. The final thing I'll say about this is that I have a training called Scale Your Studio, where I basically give all the processes that I worked out with Alicia, how I hired her, how we built systems in the studio, the ways that we did that, a listing of all the jobs and the processes associated with them that I did in my small studio. And this training is robust enough that I've even had mid-size and larger studios gather things from it. I have my whole very detailed 8-step hiring process in it. So that's something that people are interested in. Just go to growyourmusicstudio.com/contact, send me a little message there. Happy to tell you more about it. So Amy asked, let me find it. There. I'm wondering how Nate communicates his long-term plan for his students to their families. How does he get them to understand what will happen when they stay enrolled for many years? What kind of things does he do for them that gets them excited to stay? So Nate, I'm going to kick that to you because she specifically asked that of you.
Love it. You know, I'm going to pull the question here because there's a bunch of sub questions within it that I appreciate. I think one of the most, you've heard me speak this way numerous times on the podcast, like a broken record, right? You're just like, Nate, when will Nate stop talking about purpose and values? probably never this lifetime, but I think the very first thing to remember is that you have one of the hats you wear is visionary messenger. If you're the founder of your school or studio, that's one of the most important hats you wear, right? You probably, number one, don't run out of money. Number two, have a clear vision and message it in any way, shape, or form possible. So let me give you just, and that is at that sort of like 10,000 foot, or even not even 30,000, just 10,000, like 10,000 foot. Here's why we're all in the building. Here's why we're in this building here at 495 Carroll in Brooklyn. And so what does that mean? How do we communicate the long-term plan? Well, you know, if we had more time, I would actually do a roundtable and ask you all this same question. But here's how we do it here. Number one, you always make it, at BMF, we always make it family focused, right? So it's not about the instrument, it's about the family. Number two, we talk about a musician's journey. We've done some good podcasts on that. We're literally just about, we're recording this late March. This will come out later than that. But in April, in about a week and a half, we do our all staff meeting and the whole thing is dedicated to the musician's journey report, which is precisely what you're talking about, which is envisioning the journey of a student or a family at BMF and then being able to communicate that in a sort of report that we email to the parents, right? So number one, we're talking about the family and their journey. And we always use language like 7 to 10 years is how long a family stays at BMF to complete their journey, right? Secondly, so you're going to come up with creative ways to share that. But just to be clear, at every single songwriting party, I will mention that. When I'm out in the community room and a parent's asking me about what piano to buy, I will mention that. I'll be like, usually we can start with this mini keyboard and mini keys, but by the time Abby is 7 or 8, she's going to move to this full-size weighted keyboard, and that'll get her through the next 5 to 7 years here at BMF, and probably all the way to college, honestly. She can take that to the dorm. And notice that language just presupposes that they're here for 10 years and then they're taking that piano. It has nothing to do with buying a piano. It has to do with that journey, right? So if we rewind tape for a second and just ask ourselves, do we actually believe that? That is fundamental to this question. Are you still using language like, this student's talented, but this one isn't, so she'll stay, but he won't. This student's ADHD, but this one isn't, so he's going to bop out after a year, but she won't. If you're still using language like that, then you have other work to do, back to Daniel's point around personal resistance, right? What is your mindset shift you need to make? You can't speak to me as a parent about the journey and staying at your school for 7 to 10 years if you actually have a whole bunch of criteria as to whether or not I even qualify. Right? I hope that that sinks in a little bit. You really have to contemplate that, because nobody's going to convince anybody. Just think about the last time someone was trying to convince you to do something, but you didn't actually fully have faith that they even believed it was possible. I mean, that's happening all the time in our current environment, right? Back to social media. It's happening all the time. You're getting fed a boatload of IG Instagram ads by people that actually haven't done the thing, right? So anyways, that's just like going meta for a second. Next thing is just to be super concrete. You're using every public space you have and opportunity you have to share the vision, and you're baking it into whatever the answer is. You know, the questions about a keyboard, you're baking in the musician's journey in your answer about how to buy a keyboard. Secondly, you're finding 1 or 2 opportunities every year to remind families about that. So we use the musician's journey report. It's a very specific thing that we do, and we put in time and effort and money to make sure we do it. Daniel, I can't remember the app we did on it, but we did a pretty good episode on musician's journey reports. The last thing I'll say is that in terms of, let me go back to your question and make sure that what kind of things do we do to get them excited to stay? This is a great question, part of the question. When you consider the path of your musician at your school, you do want to think, like, I always use this image of, like, I'm trying to get across the river. There's about 7 stones that I need to step on to get across them. So you think of your product suite at your school as a series of stones that the student's going to move step by step across before they leave into the big bad world of college or beyond, or whatever your journey is supposed to be. Maybe you only take kids from 4 to 8 years old. So at age 9, they move on, right? The point is that each one of those stones you need to have clarity on. So at BMF, for example, we want all of our students to start in mini keys. That's 4 and 5 years old. They start in this group songwriting class where they're developing fluencies. That's where we want them to start. From there, we want them to graduate to Jam Band 101. Why is that exciting? Because in Jam Band 101, we add the luge, we add guitar into the band. And then from Jam Band 101, we want them to graduate to whatever instrument is most exciting to them. That's in the private lesson program, which is now a 6-year-long songwriting program on whatever instrument that they're excited by. By the way, after they take private lessons for a year or two, the next stone is that they add our advanced band songwriting, our Rock, Write, and Record, that goes along with that private lesson. You can't be in Rock, Write, and Record unless you're in a private lesson. So now they're moving from Rock, Write, and Record, they're going to record a 4-song EP each year, and they're going to be in private lessons as they're graduating level by level through the songwriter's journey. So these students, like literally Miles, is like, I can't believe I'm in intermediate one level of the songwriting journey. Like, he literally said that this season. And you're just like, dude, you're so cute. And of course you're an intermediate songwriting one, dude. This is like your sixth songwriting party you've played. You've graduated to intermediate. And then the kids that leave the songwriter's journey, that's at puberty, basically. 12, 11, 12, 13 is when they leave. And they go into our showcase series, and that's the first time they're playing cover songs. Right? And so when they graduate into showcase, I have a student now who's graduating who's like 11, and he's like a little nervous. But I'm like, don't worry, next fall, dude, I got you. We're going to make sure you're in a great group. You're going to be collaborating with great teens when you play that showcase. So the answer to how to get them excited is to always know where what the next stone is for your student, and then to be talking about it 6 to 12 months before they take the step. That's the key right there. You know where your student's going to be in 12 months, and you're talking about it 12 months before they even step. So by the time, like in April, when we're re-enrolling, when I'm building bands for next fall, by the time we're doing that, they've already heard about the band that they're going to join for months. You dig? Like, does that make sense to everybody? One of the common pitfalls, and then we'll ping it back to you, Daniel. One of the common pitfalls is that people don't actually know where their student's going to go next. And the people that really don't know where the student's going to go next are your young teachers you're trying to train, because they have no experience. You can't have a 24-year-old teacher who can envision a student 7 years from now, because they haven't even been teaching for 7 years. Right? Write that down and contemplate that, because that's really important when it comes to, you know, talking about training, leveling up your teachers, because you as the founder are the one who has to train them to that. And you as the founder are the one who has to set the stones across the river. You're the one. It's not somebody else deciding. It's you. And so you start by really practicing a ton yourself. And then you can train well to that. And your teachers will aspire to be able to speak like you. That's all I got on that one. I hope that was a good enough answer.
I think it was great. And I would mention one thing you said there that I think is the cornerstone of everything you said. And that is knowing what the next step is. Of course, you meant this, Nate. You didn't say it, but I know you meant this. You don't just know the next step. You know all the steps. It's kind of what you were alluding to with the younger teachers not knowing what those are. So I know you totally meant that. What I would say is that obviously Brooklyn Music Factory has a very unique program. And I sometimes wonder if people who've been listening to us for the last 2.5 years associate that 7 to 10 year journey with BMF's program specifically.
Right, totally.
But what I would say is that if you are not Brooklyn Music Factory, because there's only one in the world, if you're not Brooklyn Music Factory, this does not preclude you from doing something similar. Let's say you're a classical music-based music school. Mm-hmm. You can write out a 7 to 10 year journey, ideally for a student, that talks about the kinds of things they're going to be able to do in certain methods. If you have them in something like AMEB, ABSRM, Royal Conservatory, you talk about those milestones. You could potentially add in other stepping stones along the journey that you allude to. I know of one school that they have their journey painted onto their wall.
I love that.
Yeah. You do too, Nate, in a way. When we were there, you have all the programs up there.
Right, totally. Yeah.
You know, we should get footage of that and just cut it in over this.
I should say a photo. I pulled these down, Daniel, because in the early years of BMF, we used the music tree method religiously with our pianists. And the only thing we did was build all these super dope jam tracks at multiple tempos for the students to play along with. But we had a very clear journey that moved them through three books. So that should feel really familiar to a lot of the piano teachers listening. Just like, sure. It doesn't have to be a proprietary, like, it doesn't have to be your own curriculum. Doesn't have to be the songwriter's journey. It can be exactly what you want. You just have to think through those stones.
Yeah. And the hack that I would give is look at both the average student that has successfully gone through a lot of those stepping stones historically, and think about what they were in a fair level of detail and make it results based. Not, oh, they passed this book. Talk about what they could do.
Yep.
And then think about a really A+ student. There are names in my head of students that came to my studio that were far above the average, and think about things that they were able to do. And you can paint that vision as well. It's hard to hit a target you can't see. And a family, if they don't have something to aspire to, if a student doesn't have something to aspire to, what are the odds they're going to stick around? But we're not communicating, and we're not doing it in an aspirational way. And I found that the results of my studio greatly increased when I had that vision painted for people. So is there any pushback on this or any follow-up questions? I see that some people wrote some things in the chat. Becca said, basically, we need to have a destination in mind and take every opportunity to talk about the destination. That's a good summary.
Yeah. Yes. And you can have multiple destinations that parents can better understand. Like, a parent of a 4-year-old doesn't understand getting into the arts high school.
Mm-hmm.
But a parent of a 4-year-old can imagine, playing their first recital. A parent can understand playing their fifth recital. A parent can understand of a 4-year-old playing for their grandparents in the next couple of years. Like, that's something that they can understand. And then a parent of a 7-year-old can imagine joining a band, right? And then the parent that's joined the band can imagine their kid joining concert band in middle school. Now all of a sudden they can imagine maybe applying to that auditioning for that arts high school. Right. So you've got these stages of growth or progress, you know, or I don't even love the word progress, just steps on the journey, really.
Yeah. Cool stuff. Okay. By the way, the Musician's Journey podcast is episode 29. We released it on June 1st, 2022. So it's a while back there.
But classic.
It's a classic. Every episode that we release is an instant classic, Nate.
It's a classic.
Oh, my goodness. All right. Let's move to another question here. So the question was submitted by Kim, who I've actually known for many years. She's got a studio in outside of Philadelphia. I would love to hear from those with kids how they manage their studios as well as their home responsibilities. I'm a new mom. My husband is on the road a lot, so I am mostly on my own and find it really difficult to carve out the time for the studio like I used to now that I have much more responsibility at home. This is a good one.
This is a real one. Very real.
And again, this is one where if anyone's bold enough, and you have something to contribute, you know, just put in the chat there. If you've got a nice idea, a hack, a tip, would love to hear it. Do you want to start this one, Nate, or do you want me to?
Let me see. I'm going to share one story and then ping it right back to you to see if I have anything more value. A lot of what I would say to this is that it sort of touches on what I was saying when I kept taking my hat on and off earlier in the app, which is that as studio owners, we become very comfortable, or hopefully we develop the wisdom and get more comfortable with knowing which bucket of business, whether it's marketing, sales, or delivery on promise, or just operations, that we need to prioritize. And so, Daniel, I'd get back to your comment. If you've really got mastered your marketing, then maybe it's time to bring on that admin, right? What I would say is, yeah, here we have now a profound responsibility that's entered our life, right? We've got a child that we are now, you know, we're parenting in a way that's just, yeah, it's like, it's a radically new set of priorities if we're a new parent, right? And so what we need to do, or what I've done, is just be very clear, first of all, on exactly what areas of my business require me and only me. There are areas of the business that are good enough, that don't need Nate, like is quality control to audit. They just are, like a lot of, like our whole private lesson department is way better than good enough. That doesn't need me to go in there and wonder if we're on purpose and message, right? Our camp is way better than good enough. I don't need to do anything there except for to do the budget and make sure they have the money they need to run it, right? There's just, so what I would do as a new parent is I would be like, okay, where am I basically, do I have faith in my studio? And what aspects of this studio am I still nervous about? Okay. Then what I would do is I would basically be like, okay, I know I'm prioritizing my family. And in the case of this, yeah, great. In the case of this, you're single, you're mostly single parenting, right? Because your partner's has to travel for work. Okay, dig it. And what I would do is, like, knowing I'm prioritizing that and therefore have minimal time to work on those high priority, you're then just looking for your windows of opportunity. And unfortunately, as new parents, our windows of opportunity are nap time and late night. That's the bummer about it, right? We're like, we don't have a lot of windows where we absolutely know we can be fully focused on the business. And that's the last thing I'll say. And then actually, I'd love to ping it to you, Josh, because I know you're managing this, and you said you'd like to share what's working for you, which would be beautiful. But I'm going to say this, is that early on, pre-Brooklyn Music Factory, when I was doing a lot of scoring for film and television and writing for Oprah and all this stuff, and my daughters were young, I was always on the playground, like, taking work calls and trying to multitask, and it sucked. I'm sure you all have felt this way before, but I wasn't a good dad and I wasn't a good composer for whatever I was working on, because basically both my kids and my business were getting like 50% of you. Of me,
yeah.
You know? And so it just is a drag. And so at some point I had to actually get disciplined to be like, okay, when you're, for example, right now, if you're going to work on your school, find that window of opportunity when you can put 100% of yourself in, even if it's only like an hour and a half a day, right? And then just allow yourself to be fully, I mean, I know it's idealistic, but allow yourself to be fully in parent mode when you can be. Because the truth is that new lead that came in to convert to your studio, they can wait 24 hours. That's the actual truth on it. Like you're so Daniel, could we ping it to Josh and hear what he wanted to share on that?
Yeah, I love it.
So yeah, I mean, I'll share you what kind of works for us. And you know, relatively we're a smaller school. We got like 33, 35 students. And so but one thing I did earlier on, and this is with the help of some coaching with Nate and stuff, is that we just time blocked every hour that we know we just are not going to give up for family. So the very first thing, I have a blank slate to have on my hour slots. And I said, okay, you know, my wife and I had a heart to heart. She's like, look, we got three kids under 5 years old right now. So it's a crazy time in life. And we never hardly sleep, but it's good. And she's like, I really need you home to like help cook supper, because she works a 9-to-5. She's in healthcare. She's wore out at the end of the day, making decisions all day. She's like, I just need you home to like cook, help get the kids ready to do the night thing. And I need you here on weekends to be a dad. So I was like, all right, you know, if that's going to be what's the priorities are, then let's rock and roll. So I blocked off my weekends and my nights, which is really hard to do in our industry. And it's impossible for some people probably. But I said, you know, and that's one reason we're probably not, you know, it limits growth to a degree too, because you miss out on that. And that kind of came where Mason comes in handy now, because Mason is in a point of life where he just got engaged. They're about to get married this fall, moved to Nashville, do the music thing. But he's available in the evenings now. So now he's teaching the evening classes. He gigs on weekends, so we don't actually teach on the weekends. That's something we could do down the road, but that's just where we're at in our studio journey. But that's the biggest thing, was like just time blocking the time that are non-negotiable. That said, look, no matter what, I'm just gonna either have to miss the lesson or figure something out. And then, but that pushes you to get creative and think of other outlets. Like then, you know, a year and a half ago or whatever it was, I stumbled into Daniel's group training thing. I'm like, all right, well, there's something to this. Now I can actually get my time back and maximize those and actually do something more creative with the little time I do have available. And that's really when it started taking off. And so, anyway, yeah, that's kind of what works for us, is time block, don't negotiate on it, and do group stuff and try to get your time back somehow.
Love that. I will add on to something that you're saying there, that time blocking, definitely agree with that. The other thing that I would say was huge for me was that 3 months after my son was born, my wife got a promotion at work. She actually went in while she was on maternity leave to interview for a job in the company she was already in. That was a significant jump in responsibility. It was kind of her dream job, significant jump in responsibility and pay and in hours. When she came off maternity leave, she had, I think, 1 or 2 weeks at her old position. And then she moved into this new job and they were like 60-hour work weeks. And I was at home with a 3-month-old. And she was gone from basically 7 o'clock in the morning to 6 o'clock at night. And I learned very quickly that the relative lack of structure that I had in my day to do all the business tasks I needed to get done, that wasn't going to cut it anymore. And I had to get much more regimented and disciplined to get everything done that I wanted to get done. And while that might sound like maybe a good portion of the audience's personal definition of hell, what I found was that it actually was a stress reducer for me, to the point that I looked back at my time before and thought, man, I wasted all this time. I should have been doing some of these more disciplined ways of running my day. Simple things like planning. You know, I've even talked about this in the podcast before. These habits that I have in place, they really started around this time, like right after my son was born. Planning my week in advance, coming up with project and task lists so that if I had a free 15 minutes during the day, I could just go to a predetermined list of things that I had put in order of importance and not waste that 15 minutes. I learned how to use blocks of time, you know, to get the most efficiency and productivity out of them. I started getting up earlier before everyone else was awake and getting the really important stuff done then. There was just all kinds of things that I did. And of course, as he got older, you know, the demands on your time as a parent change as children age. And through each phase that he was going through each stage of life that he was going through, these core systems that I had kind of sustained me through them. And while I had to make adjustments in schedule and time and how I did things, those core disciplines that were very, very simple to implement and understand really sustained me through all of them. And I even went through one this past year where we stopped homeschooling him and we enrolled him in a private school. And so completely different schedule now. And just night and day difference to what we had been doing before. And once again, all these things that I've had in my life now for decade plus kind of helped me transition through that very, very smoothly. And while my day looks different now and my calendar looks different and how I portion time and that sort of thing looks different, I'm still getting things done, and the transition was fairly easy because I had these structures in place in life. So I think that's one other way, you know, to handle that. Really appreciate everyone coming out today.
Yeah, thank you everyone for making the time and bringing great questions too. Daniel, I'm reminded of before I had children, how busy I thought I was.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely.
Then the J team and I had our first child, and I was like, oh, to your point, I had no idea what it meant to be efficient with time.
Yeah.
Because I thought I had all the time in the world.
Yeah. I'll add on just one tiny thing, like 30 seconds. The beautiful thing about our industry is I was able to hire an army of babysitters because I knew all these kids that I taught the years, you know? And there were students of mine where literally I had these two girls who were two sisters, one in middle school, one in early high school. They would have their lesson at the beginning of the day, and then they would go into the back part of my house and just watch my son for the rest of the day until Jessica got home. And nice. I was personal family friends, so, you know, there was a lot of trust there between me and the parents there, where, you know, that was cool. But I had a schedule I had set up where a lot of teenage girls in my studio, I would contact their moms and I would send a monthly schedule out where they could sign up for slots on my babysitting calendar I set up for myself. And the girls would just go in and set up times where they'd come, where they were basically like, you know, in-home helper type thing so that I could get work done during the day.
I love that. Yeah, or Pearl, my youngest, was a in-home helper for my business partner.
Yeah.
For Vera. Thank you all. Thanks, Daniel. This is great. I appreciate all the questions. Appreciate everybody in the chat too sharing. And let's do it again.
I would love that. All right. Hey, until next time, everybody. See you later. Love you all. Have a great day. Have a good rest of your week. And we will see you all soon. Bye.
Thank you.
Hey, it's Nate again. You know, every year at Brooklyn Music Factory, we get dozens and dozens of great reviews from our families. And you want to know how? Because we ask them. And they're happy to leave a review because of the positive impact that we've made on them. And so now I have a simple ask for you. If this podcast, the 7FMS podcast, was helpful to you, would you mind leaving a review for Daniel and I? And please share the podcast with another music school owner that you think might benefit. It's one of the best ways that you can support us. We appreciate it.